Here too. We're having some pizza, and out of the way. What? Hooray, Pap Cheer. All right, let me see now. Wait a minute. We had the Velvet Underground. That's Lou Reed's song there. We had the Sex Pistols, and we had The Who, which is the intro that Bono asked for. Bono and Larry and The Edge, you're very welcome to the program. Where's Adam gone?
He's in the John.
He's in the John. That's fair.
With John.
So, listen, you've just had about an awful lot of food, boxes of pizzas. So maybe I should just play a record before I ask a question, will I? Tell us about T-Bone Burnett, Bono.
I was just about to tell you about
Okay.
Right. Okay. So, he wanted to buy some books from me. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Right. I was just about to tell him about T-Bone Burnett. Adam's just back.
He's
coming on the program when? Next Friday?
No, about 2 weeks' time.
And Elvis Costello probably with him. The two of them are going out, you see, as the Carrad brothers.
Mm.
And he was buying books from me in New York, and he bought a book of Noel Carrad's verse. And he brought it up to the lady behind the cashier. And she says, an incredible man, Noel Carrad. T-Bone Burnett, this Texan with an absolutely straight face, said, I know, he was my father. And she says, he was your father. And he said, yes, but pleased to meet you, Howard Carrad. And they're very serious about being the Carrad brothers, Elvis Costello and himself, and they go out playing country and western version. That's all, really.
That's a great hit.
Good story. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, 9 out of 10 for that one.
Adam, tell us what's about the corpse in the Holiday Inn.
I think.
What have you got on the record?
I think, really, in all seriousness, at this point, particularly with my recent run-in with the Garda, I think we should keep that well quiet till next year.
Well quiet till next year. All right, fair enough. So listen, tell us then about the gig. First of all, this coming Saturday, the longest day. Who's on the bill with you in London?
Spear of Destiny.
Wow, that's heavy edge. The Faith Brothers, REM. Come on, Lord.
Billy Bragg.
The Ramones, yeah, the Ramones.
So we got a nice cross section, a nice selection of talent there.
Young talent. Edge is our talent scout, Dave.
Fair enough, Bono.
This is due to his Indian heritage.
That's very obscure.
Tracking bands.
I think I should play a track. Look,
yeah, let's have Marvin.
I think we should let him digest our pizzas.
But my voice is
our badass pizzas. Right, here's Marvin Gaye for Edge.
Stop right on.
All right, that was The Who live. This time was The Right Side, and let's get down to something now. I think we've had a lot of music for the last half hour. Are we all settled? We are. Okay, boys, let's start with a serious one.
I met a guy from Mount Temple in the corridor. I swear to God, I just went into the toilet, and he was standing there next to me, you know, doing what men do, and he told me he was from Mount Temple 2N.
Not 2N, that was a really naff. Really naff. That'd be really sick.
We didn't have any streaming, by the way, where we went to school. Like, there was no A class and B class. In fact, it was DUB. Remember?
L-I-N.
And this guy's from N, which is like the last one. Really bad laugh. If he's out there, you should get him in, because it's amazing. Apparently, Moxham takes him from history.
Moxham is listening right now. Hi, Donald.
I always wanted to do that, you know?
Okay, how about a heavy one? Now that you're playing to the biggest crowds imaginable, do you find it harder for the audience to participate in the celebration, or do you actually rise to the occasion, you two?
Now, is this one of your own questions?
This is one of my own, yeah.
I don't know.
That's a hard one.
Bono would like to answer that.
Ah, pass.
I mean, like, there's a lot of bands who say that once they get to a certain crowd that it gets a bit silly, that they'd rather play with a small one. Now, I get the impression, certainly having seen the, take two, that they'd rather play to a small crowd.
We like the
crowd.
Band we've got, actually, Dave.
It's going to be one of those. No, but I mean, like, for instance, now, at Madison Square Gardens, like, I mean, the very fact that there were so many there, it seemed like a better gig than I've seen you play, saying, ah, this is ridiculous. Not getting anywhere.
What were you doing to the King's
No.
I know.
Just do you, Edge?
I know what it feels like.
He's always the lick.
I'm always the lick.
Go on, Edge, you answer.
I think, wasn't it the bass player from Lone Justice said he's been at many a club where the atmosphere was awful, where there was no excitement, there was no communication, and
there's
conversely,
no
he has been in many ice hockey arenas at gigs where the opposite was true, where there was a great deal of excitement and communication and just a great atmosphere. I don't think it actually has anything to do with the
proximity.
It's all to do with the band.
Yeah, well, I must say I'd agree with the bass player in the band, and if that's the case. No, I would. I mean, having seen Masquerade, I'd throw him out. Adam, get out. All right, now, how much tighter, say, than in the early days is that separation between the performer and the audience? I mean, like, how much different is it? I mean, do you find it a bit difficult? You have to sort of rise to the occasion in a totally different way.
Was this sandwich, right? Went into a bar. And it eased its way through a few pork pies. It goes no, this sandwich.
I was made
hold
of
it. This sandwich, right, goes into the bar and says, he says to the guy, you know, the guy behind the bar, he says, listen, he says, I'll have a pint of Guinness. And the fellow says, I'm sorry, we don't serve sandwiches.
Yeah, right. Anyway,
that's sick. That is the worst joke.
I've told that one several times today. I liked it every time.
I think it's good, yeah. Leaves a nasty taste.
Who are you voting for tomorrow?
I am. I'm not telling you.
Get up. Who are you voting for, Edge?
I'll tell you about this thing about being close to the
edge.
Audience.
About being close to the audience. It's not about being close to the audience. And the guy, what Edge was trying to say there is, you can go into a club and...
obviously failed this one.
What was that?
That was a green pepper. He assaulted you with a piece of green pepper.
Right, anyway, pizzas are out from now on. No, I don't think it's about being close physically. It's about being close to your audience in terms of the way you feel about them and the way they feel about you. And there's a lot of bands that are in the small... Oh, don't do that. There's a lot of bands are in a small club and they're just as cold. You know, they're just there and they're playing guitar and they're singing their songs, but they still feel like 100 yards up from their audience. And we don't feel that way about our audience, and that's why it's going to be close no matter what the distance is.
That answers the question perfectly, Bono. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, do you, for instance, always go out on stage, like in a 40-day tour of the States, it must be really sort of pretty grueling stuff. Do you go out on stage and every night you say, it's got to be better than the previous night, and that's how you make it good? Is that the way you sort of have to psych yourself up? And
Bono actually gets us down, I mean, all sitting around in the dressing room, and he says, right, 101% edge, and he points
on and off the field.
And we do 15 press-ups and about 35 sit-ups, and then we jog on the spot for about 5 minutes, and then we go out on stage.
And if we're the last man to finish, we have to stand on our head for a while.
You know, there's a lot of people out there, they know us so well, that they know the answers to those questions. Let's play some music.
What a politician. Let's play some music.
What about that, Ed?
Gosh, that was quick, all right. That's The Light Pours Out of Me. That was from Magazine, and that was another one of Bono's choices. Now, let's talk about the last LP, The Unforgettable Fire. Is there any way that The Unforgettable Fire was sort of a combination of both Boy and War in some ways? For those sort of like, Boy was U2, War was sort of worldly matters sort of thing, and that you, like the Unforgettable Fire was able to bring the fans from both of those together?
I think it confused everyone, actually. I don't think it brought anyone together, because it was such a departure from what people were expecting. We were determined that it would be different, that it would redefine U2, and that was really the basis of the choice as, you know, as producer. But
it certainly confused
me. I'm still coming to terms with it. Yeah, I mean, it's my favourite album by a long way of the ones we've done, primarily because I'm still seeing new things in it.
Mm-hmm. It really did confuse the group as well as everybody else. I think that's true. And you know, when we put it out, we kind of felt, well, God, what have we? You know, we've put this out, and it was a very personal record, a very intimate record. And for that reason, it was, you know, we were wondering, you know, can we get away with this? And we believed so much in it, and Eno and Lanwa believed so much in it. And Paul believed so much, and everybody around us believed in it. But we wondered, would anyone else out there believe in it? And we're just actually completely blown away by the fact that other people are blown away by that record. And it's just great that our most progressive record to date has been our most popular.
Well, like on that level as well, then, do you think that the fact that it takes time for people to get into the LP, I mean, obviously the fans are going to buy it, but in the end, for, say, new U2 fans, it's actually more rewarding in the end because it takes so much time.
I think what's great about the record is that it actually does challenge and confuse people all the way along. I think that there's an awful lot of records that are put out and they're challenging, but then somebody comes along by way of doing an interview or whatever and explains it and justifies it. And in a way, that takes the sting out of the tail of a record. I think if a record is something that cannot necessarily be justified or talked about articulately, but is something that people like for irrational reasons or not, that is music on the level it is meant to be taken, as opposed to doing interviews or photographs or image or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like the people who run the music business, that is radio and record, I think they really underestimate the listening ear of the people out there. And that's why for the last 10 years it has such garbage and it's bands that feel, well, you know, we've got to spell it out, you know, and we've got to explain ourselves, we can't make anything too complicated. I think that's just an insult. I found it insulting when I was buying records. And okay, so the record isn't full of hit singles and it isn't full of easy to work out words and music, but it's full, you know, and I'm just so glad that everyone else, I'm just amazed that so many people bought it, actually.
Mm-hmm. I think within the context of Unforgettable Fire, we should also include those outtakes which were on the Unforgettable Fire double pack and 12-inch, because I think they're almost part of that record, and they provide a key in many ways.
Well, at Slane Castle and then on to Windmill Lane, you did make 25 different pieces of music, 10 of which turned up on the LP. And the thing is, like, how trying is it on you two and sort of the whole lot of you just sort of making a record when your ability as a musician is constantly being sort of questioned and bombarded and that? Like, was it a difficult time? Is it always more difficult making a record, say, than touring?
It's more continuously challenging, because when you get into the sort of rhythm of a tour, there's a certain thing that happens where you sort of not relax, but you're able to, as it were, forget about the problems of playing. You've got over that mountain. You're now concerned mainly with, you know, communication and what have you. In a record situation, that challenge to create and be different never lets up. From the moment you go into the studio, you're constantly aware that what you do at the stage is going to be immortalized. It'll be on vinyl and people will talk about it for years to come, and you'll have to live with it. And
so, or else they won't.
Well, yeah. Even if they don't, you know, it's still there, you know, forever. So it's a different sort of pressure.
Well, do you think that before you even started to work with Eno, the very fact that you got him to do the producing of the LP, that, like, that sort of defined the new U2 even before you started, and you had a challenge in that? Like, it was obviously going to be totally different than what you'd done before.
Well, that was definitely part of it. We really wanted to change all the things within our power that could be changed that influence what we come up out with on an album. So the first thing was producer, second thing was studio, I suppose the third thing would be approach to songwriting itself. All those things we mess around with. The strange thing is how discernibly U2 it sounds after having messed around so much with our style of work. I don't know whether that's good or bad, but it really, it's kind of very much like what the other albums are.
Well, Edge, getting Eno in for the LP then, I mean, was it the Eno of Roxy Music, or was it the Eno of Talking Heads' David Bowie production? Was it the Eno of Before and After Science, Taking Tiger Mountain by Strategy, or was it the Eno of Ambient Music? I mean, what was it that you wanted? How is it you knew about Eno?
Well, first of all, we knew Eno through his own work and obviously the early Roxy Music stuff, but primarily through things like Before and After Science. Then through Talking Heads. We love Talking Heads, but you know, none of us really think of those projects as being Eno's work per se. It's really, I suppose, a combination of what he had managed to pull out of the various artists that he'd produced. I mean, Bowie as well, that was Heroes and Low were favourite albums of all of ours. And I suppose that we saw the strength of his influence on people. We realised that
Bowie.
Because
Bowie had actually... had come clean on this and had said to the press and to people around him that Eno in some ways dug him out, because he was in a real watershed at one point when he just climbed down from being the rock and roll star, Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane, and even Diamond Dogs. And he went to Berlin, he lived in Berlin, and he said of Eno that Eno completely changed his approach, not to making music, but to listening to music, and therefore to making music. And I think that quote got through to us, really, because that's what we were about. We wanted to change our approach to listening music as well as making music. And of course, the Talking Heads, because those three records that he made with them were so great. Even if one of the earlier records is one of my favourites as well.
Mm.
Love Goes to a Building,
which we're going to play in a few minutes.
Oh, great.
But besides that, what about many years ago? Was there an Eno connection with you, Edge, when you were doing I Threw a Brick Through a Window? Now, you stayed up all night one night in the studio with the October album with Steve Lillywhite.
That's right, yeah.
And there was something to do with Eno there in terms of your...
That was
influence.
A particular track that, in fact, it was a different technique. What happened, I was listening to Before and After Science, one of the tracks on that, and they, in the production, the mix had put an echo on the snare drum, which gave it a sort of rolling rhythmic effect. When we were putting together A Brick Through a Window, I just had this idea to use some sort of similar echo on a percussion instrument. It turned out that we used rotor toms, very highly tuned toms. So it was a borrowed idea rather than rehashing the thing exactly. But I mean, the two tracks sound totally different. But it is a case where an idea from someone else's record fitted in very nicely to something that we were doing.
Well, then the LP, The Unforgettable Fire. What about, just take two of the songs, Wire and Bad. Now, Bono, what about you with those two songs as regards the lyrics? Saying, for instance, on stage in Madison Square Gardens, you mentioned about heroin in Dublin. The song Wire, I'm wide awake, I'm not sleeping. What's all that about? And the fact that you even do the Lou Reed bit with the wire around the arm.
Well, I don't know. I can't really explain myself very well. In the interviews, I suppose I can explain it better through the song. And performance of that song. There are some people that I love in this city, and that I hope love me, who very nearly lost their lives through this very dangerous drug heroin. And I didn't know really... I didn't know it was affecting me, I didn't know how much it was affecting me. But the way we were working on The Unforgettable Fire, which was just sketches, really, I found out that I was sketching this song, and it was bad. And I found out that the images that I used were directly relating to something that I hadn't planned to... plan a song around. But the song Bad, in some ways, has, even on stage now, has just taken on a life of its own, and taken over our lives when we're on stage. It's definitely bigger than all of us. It's my own favorite track on the record, and it's my favorite track to perform.
I think in many ways when we're writing, Bono's inspired musically to write a melody, but to a greater extent, part of that melody hinges on the lyrical content that he sees in it. And that is something that may not come to light until a month or two after the record is really finished. And it's in performance that I think the songs come out in the real context of what Bono is trying to articulate, because I think you have to accept that creating musically or whatever is maybe not really a conscious effort or a conscious thing. It is something that comes through with the creation of the various things around it, like the music and the melodies and that sort of thing.
Wire was the same, you know, like wire was just an image I had, you know, of the hypodermic needle. And I'm sure it means different things to different people.
Well, what about the title track of the LP then? Like, just this is just one song I just want to talk about, which is like, I mean, the unforgettable fire, Carnival, the wheels flying, colour spin, turn alcohol, red wine that punctures the skin, face to face in a day and in a dry and waterless place. Mm. Now, like, what was that all about? You wrote that in Tokyo in a hotel.
Yeah, I wrote it in a hotel room. You know, people expect you two to be so up, you know, that sometimes it's confining because, like anyone else, you know, we go down. And that particular song documents, if you like, a lower side, you know. It's very personal. I don't really want to, you know, to get into it, but I think what people relate to is the mood of the music as well as the actual the words. And the reason I got, The Unforgettable Fire, okay, was a title that came from an exhibition of paintings and writings done by survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This is like a national art treasure in Japan. And these paintings and drawings have to be seen nearly for the bomb to be believed. They say more than any photograph could say, for instance. They're just paintings done by 5-year-olds or 55-year-olds. Some had never painted before, and some had painted all their lives, but they just exorcised from themselves the fear they felt over the Holocaust in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. They did these paintings, and we'd seen them. We bumped into them in the Chicago Peace Museum. We had an exhibit there along with Stevie Wonder, Yoko Ono, The Clash, about basically the peace movement, starting with going right the way back to Woody Guthrie and on. And we saw these paintings, and I just couldn't really forget about them. They were just like stained, if you like, on my memory. Mm. And being in Tokyo, and Tokyo that night looked like a Christmas tree. It's as an industrial city, there are just roads everywhere. There are neon signs everywhere. It just lights up like a Christmas tree. And I wrote that song, which combines so many things, you know, my own feelings.
Well, what about the idea of recording, first of all, before you go into a studio? Do you think that a studio can deaden a band's sound, and sort of like that you have to get used to some other different place and then take these ideas which you had worked out, in other words, in this case, in Slane, to Windmill, as opposed to doing it just in there?
There's different sorts of studios. It's not easy to really describe the studio. For us, I think the idea of using a very, very ambient acoustic environment was appealing. When you're playing or singing in a huge room, it just sounds so rich. It's got all the natural reverberation. In a way, it's the closest thing you get to the sound of a live concert. And those two things were the things that we wanted to experiment with on this record. Try to capture the live quality of U2, because we know ourselves, and a lot of people have said it before, that this band is a very different entity when it's on a stage in front of a live audience. There's a quality to what we do. There's a spontaneity and a chemistry that is between the members of the band that is almost impossible to recreate in a conventional studio setup where you're recording different instruments at different times. So we were trying to erode that sort of problem, at the same time getting some sounds that were natural, that didn't rely on technology to fill in those reverbs and ambiences. Mm. And that was really the reason why we chose Slane. Also, I suppose, because being such a different working environment, it meant that we were not comfortable. There's a real danger to being overcomfortable in music. You can become, you know, caught up in some sort of treadmill, in some sort of rut. And that was definitely something we wanted to avoid.
Mm. I think we also were beginning to realise that the key to U2 and everything that we do is not... I mean, our responsibility is not towards technique. It's responsibility to the morale in which we create and the way in which we work. And I think Slane certainly made us feel much more a band than being in a studio would ever have done at that point.
Just again on the subject of the Unforgettable Fire, just I'd forgotten to mention that we actually have, we're bringing lithographs and prints of that exhibition to Dublin for the Croke Park concert, so that for the week, I think starting on the Friday before the Saturday, running for a week, we have this exhibition brought to Dublin alongside an exhibition on the life and work of Martin Luther King. And this is we're collaborating with the Dublin City Carnival on this, and it opens in the Grapevine Arts Centre. And we're very grateful to the Grapevine Arts Centre for allowing this, because it just means that there's a lot of people coming in out of town for the concert at Croke Park, and people coming from Europe, from the mainland and from England, and they'll get a chance to just see the city and see this exhibition. I'd forgotten about that. I think that's important to mention.
Well, what about the third LP, War? Do you think the people might have taken you for granted, like that might have thought you might have been mellowing out in some ways, if War hadn't been as powerful as it was? And like, was there a decision?
There was definitely a pressure not to succumb to synthesizers and making polite, pretty songs. I think also there was a national identity in a way, that there have been comments about calling us English, which we certainly are not.
Regardless of the way I talk.
Spoken as an Irishman. I think it is a very brash, aggressive Irish record, and I don't think anyone can ever deny that.
Okay, well listen, War and the Unforgettable Fire. Do you think that passion, which is the one word that everybody uses when they talk about you two, do you think that passion is more important than technique? Or do you think the Unforgettable Fire has both those?
I think passion requires technique.
There's a passionate man over there on the...
I'm extremely passionate. Man, you want to see my passion. No, well, I mean, it's obviously a matter of opinion. I mean, there are some people who are interested purely in the technical ability of the music they're, you know, musicians they're interested in. But for me, and for, I believe, the rest of the band, it's all about feel. It's all about communication and spirit, and that's so little about technique and so much about just believing in what you're doing, and
it's just as well, really,
putting it in. Yeah,
from our point of view. I mean, what was that guy? There was some guy in a heavy metal band in some magazine called Guitar Player, and they asked him what he thought of some of the new guitar players, you know, like PH, and this guy who remained nameless.
And legless.
You remain lameless. Continue, Bono, continue.
I'm so sorry.
Must have been a bad pint, Bono.
Oh, damn the docker. Anyway, this guy, you know, he was asked about Edge, and he said, well, what do you think of the Edge? And he said,
oh, he's good, he is, but he's not very fast, is he? He's not very fast.
As if really they were talking about gunslingers. And gunslinging got into rock and roll at one point where it didn't matter about the songs you sang, it just mattered about how fast you could play them, or, you know, how well trained your voice was. None of us, I've never trained my voice in my life. I actually don't know how to sing. Edge doesn't know how to play the guitar in terms of classically. Larry might know how to drum, actually, but, you know, Adam...
It's all down to how fast you can hear, as far as I'm concerned.
No, I mean, that's not what it's about, you know. It never started out like that,
where this music began from, and it was a folk music. It was music played and listened to by
folk,
ordinary people. It was not music put together by classically trained people, and I think that, if nothing else, that's consistent now. I think that is held up, and it's still the case. It should be the case. I'm not into the sort of, you know, classically trained person turns to rock and roll and writes a concerto for the electric guitar vibe. I think it's sort of out of place.
I mean, I Will Follow was written on two strings. You know, there's two chords. And, you know, in Madison Square Gardens, we pulled a guy up on stage And we taught him four chords. And with that, with those four chords, he played Knocking on Heaven's Door with us. And we sang it with him. And that made the point, you know, four chords. What is it? G, C, A minor and D. Those four chords could write a classic like Knocking on Heaven's Door. That's all it took for Bob Dylan to write that song. And there's so many people, even listening to this program, and this is the best program in this country and any country on rock and roll. At some stage we had to say that because it's, you know, because it's true. But anyway, there's a lot of people listening to it who are into rock and roll music, just like the way, you know, that, and they listen to it because they know you're into rock and roll music. And there are a lot of lies that are told to them, like, for instance, you know, about musical technique, about having a manager, about being the biggest band in your street or the biggest band in your city. And it's not important. What is important is a song, a simple song. And all it takes to write a classic song is three chords. Not even three.
Okay, Bono, thank you very much. Wonderful, especially that last bit about the program. I agree with you entirely. We're going to be 45 seconds late with the news. First, the break. Indeed, Una, with the news. Now, let me see, where are we? We're back here live with you two. Two of them have just left us, and I don't know where they are at the moment, but it doesn't make any difference. I'm going to first of all talk to Paul McGuinness, manager of the band. Paul, there's one thing about you two in the States that people say, first of all, that in terms of all the bands that play, even the bands that sell more records than you two, that in terms of merchandise, you two sell more, that in terms of the fans are much more into you two in a sort of a really passionate way than almost into any other band. And there's one other thing that I've definitely noticed, and that is this, the business. The business really respects you two. The people over there that I met, the people here who have been over here, they always say, you two, perfect. Everything about you two is perfect. Do you find that's true? Like, this is not praise to you at all, by the way. I'm just asking, like, how do you find that? I mean, do you find that it is good to be you two in the States?
Yeah, it is great to be you two at this stage, and I'm very proud to be their manager. You two, I suppose, is what they really mean is that you two is substantial and a thing that is not going to be gone in 10 minutes' time. That's probably what they mean. And that suits the record companies and the theatre owners and the promoters and so on, because they would far prefer to deal with somebody who's going to endure. We are not enduring for their reasons, but that doesn't stop them liking the phenomenon, and I suppose that's what they mean.
But does it go further than that as well? I mean, like, for instance, you were able to renegotiate a contract with Island Records recently. Now, it's not just because, I mean, in 1984, it's not just because you two are going to obviously be successful and sell lots of albums over the next three or four LPs. It's almost definite that they will do that. But it's more to it than that. I mean, it's prestigious almost. I mean, it's like sort of CBS having Bob Dylan or something back again.
Well, yeah, it would have been quite damaging for Island to lose you two. I think they knew that as well as we did. And, but at the same time, the reason why we were with Island in the first place is the reason why we stayed with them. They respected the band from the beginning, and that respect is mutual, and it's a stylish record company to be with. That doesn't mean they sell as many records as CBS do, and there are times when that's extremely annoying. But it's a good place to be.
Well, do you find that it's not just the business that you have to be involved in 24 hours a day in America when they're on tour, but also that you have to sort of almost protect them from so many things that happen to go on over there? I mean, do you find that that's part of your job as well?
Protect these four helpless individuals, these completely helpless people. No, that's not actually what the gig is. Not really, no. I mean, U2 has always made policy as, it's a pompous expression, but we've always operated rather like a board.
Very bored.
But the policy is the responsibility of the five of us. And it has been one of the things that worked, that we always did that, and the band always seemed to find the energy to work on policy at the same time as they're having to make records.
I mean, I think the best thing Paul ever did about managing us was sort of not manage us, because early on, the four of us would kind of knock on his door and, you know, go into his flat in Waterloo Road and say, look, what can you do for us? And Paul said, well, I can't do anything for you if you don't, you know, if you're not going to do anything for yourself. And we learned, we became our own managers, if you like, under the management.
There's no point in wanting to be a rock band unless you also want to know about all the things that are necessary to be a rock and roll band. You need to know about making records, and you need to know about the world. It is not making rock and roll is not a private act. The reason why we've stopped talking is that Larry Mullen has just demolished
the clock.
Is the station still on the air?
Oh, I'm afraid we are.
Have a screwdriver. The director general will be down to see you.
Do we have to go now?
It'll be back to Big D today.
Big stop to luck, Larry.
Oh, God.
Very good.
He seems to have got it back on the wall, but is the station still on the air?
All right, listen, let's talk about Saturday week then, Paul. What have you got in terms of the lineup?
A couple of serious pieces of information. I don't know whether everyone has heard this, but this is the definitive lineup, and you can ignore anything other than these facts. Here come the facts. The running order of the show is Entuanua first, then REM, then The Alarm, then Squeeze, then U2. The tickets that people have say that the gates open at 4 p.m. This is an error.
Yeah.
The gates do not open at 4 p.m. The gates, in fact, open at 11 a.m. And obviously you don't have to be there at 11 a.m., but they will be open from 11 a.m. And obviously getting 60,000 people into a venue takes a certain amount of time, and depending on how much you want to see the other acts, you should arrive early or later. The other acts, we think, are all great acts, so we would suggest that everyone sort of come early, but that's not the way crowds arrive, so
yeah.
But 4 p.m. is definitely wrong.
Right. Well, what about these other bands then that are on? I mean, the U2 peoples. What do you think of these other bands? I mean, did you decide on these?
Well, it was REM is like one of our favorite groups from America.
One of Dave's favorite groups.
Mm. I think Entuanua, well, they just mean a lot to you two. One, because Steve Wickham played his fiddle on War, on Sunday Bloody Sunday, and Drowning Man. And
Vinny.
And well, I think they're actually breaking now in the City of London. They're just being on the phone even today. People are talking about Entuanua over there. And they're going to break through. So we're really glad to have them on. Alarm, again, they played with us in America. And we love them very much. And they're going to be, I think, a surprise on the day. Because a lot of people haven't, you know, there's not a lot of people familiar with The Alarm. And I think that they're really going to surprise people, because it doesn't matter how big a venue, they make very big music. And Squeeze have just reformed. And that's really sort of quite of a coup for us, because getting somebody to play before U2 in Dublin, was a lot of bands were just frightened out of their lives of playing in Dublin, because they knew the Irish audience was as good as it was, and they just were scared to play in front of them. This is true. This is really true. And so to have Squeeze playing, I think is something, because they broke up, I think, 2 years ago, just as they were to go become a kind of a big thing in the US and all over the world, and they actually have put themselves out,
and in fact,
to play this concert.
Squeeze also gave us breaks in the early days. We played with them up in Belfast, and we also played with them on the leak slip bill with the Police a long, long time ago. So it's going to be nice to have old friends, you know, back with us, and I think it should add very much to the day, and they're great songwriters.
Well, last week when I mentioned that you're coming in on the programme, I did say to people, oh yeah, we have a competition which we're going to do before 10 o'clock. But I did say also, if anybody's got any questions that they have, they can write them out. Now, I got loads and loads and loads of questions from England, Scotland, Wales, all over Ireland. And the main question is this, especially with the Irish ones, obviously. First of all, a lot of the English people said, thanks very much for playing in certain places. In particular, one from Manchester, which said, thanks very much for playing Manchester, because so many people seem to leave out Manchester, which surprised me greatly. But everybody wants to know, why are you only playing Dublin? You haven't played in Ireland since 1983, August the 14th, nearly 2 years, and that was Dublin as well. And you haven't, and you don't have any dates this time around, say Belfast, Galway, Cork, and they want to know why.
I'd like to know why as well, in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking, unfortunately, about the practical side of the business when you're dealing with shows of this nature. I mean, we would love to play, you know, every town in Ireland, but A, the venues aren't there, and if they were, you know, it just wouldn't make any practical sense.
We didn't want to compromise, really, the whole production that we played around the world, and we couldn't find... really, I mean, we asked Paul, we asked our agent, we asked everyone, we wanted to play Belfast, and Cork was the other place we wanted to play in conjunction with them, but all things considered, we chose, and I'm glad we chose. This is our hometown. I mean, let's face it, this is our hometown and we live here, and this is just, you know, it's a big deal for us to be playing Dublin, and you know, okay, would have been great to play Cork and Belfast and every other city in the country, but I'm not backing down from our decision to play Dublin.
I think playing Dublin and having the size of stage and all the facilities that we need has enabled us to bring a lot of people along that the audience out there would not have a chance to see. And I think that's something that shouldn't be forgotten. The fact that Squeeze are coming to Dublin for such an event, and we've got REM and The Alarm and Into a Noor, I think it makes it very worthwhile. And that's obviously not something that you can take around the country, because there is nowhere that will take 20,000 people or whatever in other cities.
I mean, it's a very large crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a whole series of reasons, and it does not reflect our own wishes necessarily, you know.
Certainly
that's the
doesn't.
Unfortunate thing.
It certainly doesn't. Cork especially. Cork City, we broke big in Cork City before we broke big in Dublin. We had to push the van down to Cork, and we used to play the Arcadia. Do you remember the guy used to drive us? He used to have to stop every 10
Alfie.
Miles. Alfie was his name. And he used to stop the van. He used to get out and he used to suck. He used to siphon the petrol and suck it and spit it out like petrol in his mouth. And we used to get down to Cork, and the people in Cork just gave it all to us. And we felt like a band there. We really felt like a band. Like, it was a big thing, and I think we really would have liked to play Cork. I mean, it just goes on and on. All the cities that have been kind of good to us. I'm getting into a very good mood. I hope I'm not going to be a pain in the arse telling everyone how much I love them. I mean, it doesn't take much, but in a drink to get me drunk. But I'm drunk on this concert, you know. I am drunk on this concert, and I'm
it's a fact that almost everyone who works for the band, almost everyone who works for the band is from Cork.
Yeah, that's very true. Let's get a Cork man in here. Can we get a Cork man in here? Yes.
Joe.
Bring him in.
Joe, the man with the beard.
A word from a Cork man.
I think it's very important to say that, right?
Joe, take a seat over there.
Right, the most important man.
I was reading the RT guide. Yeah, go on.
In front of stage is the man who does our sound, and the man who does more than our sound. He has a lot to do with the morale, and he heads what we call the Cork Mafia, which is a lot of people from Cork that make being in U2 really worthwhile. So I think you should ask him some questions about.
Tell us about Cork, Joe.
How's it going, bye? That's just the food to find. A lot of people in Cork were wondering why they picked Croke Park. And everybody else was wondering why they picked Croke
Park. And don't tell me it's because Larry played in the Artain Boys band there once.
Not at all, no. Why did the GA pick Croke Park? Because...
Why are we here?
Who are we? Because it's the most central point in Ireland. Everybody can get from A to B on a train.
a bus, a plane, or a boat. We're not forgetting about Cork this year, so everybody in Cork, come to Dublin, and we'll take care of you thereby.
Perfect. Can't argue with that. Here's Talking Heads.